Before I tell you about my love affair with Frédéric Chopin, how that got started, it's kind of a funny story, really. But I got to mention this, which is not a funny story, but is fascinating and news to me. I came across this in a column by Lee Camp. Lee wrote about the 2,000-year-old lost city. Not far from Seattle, there's a place called Cape Flattery. And back in 1970, archaeologists discovered a Maka indigenous community. It was basically a village frozen in time. You think Pompeii, right? But instead of lava, think mud. So when they started unveiling this city, it provided this snapshot of life within an indigenous tribe, and how it was wiped out by this catastrophe, this mudslide. But because the mud happened so quickly and so completely, it shielded the city from decay by oxygen. Oxygen, great stuff for us to breathe, bad in terms of preservation of our bones and whatnot. So there literally are thousands of well-preserved artifacts, and I've seen photographs of some of these really tall wooden carvings. They're amazing, and they have not rotted. There are wooden cedar baskets and dog hair blankets. Okay, don't judge. I'm not into dog hair blankets. I'm just reporting that. And wooden storage boxes. And these were all very painstakingly removed and unearthed during this archaeological dig. So my big question, which is Lee's big question too, is why are we only hearing about this now? Lee writes, every once in a while we get a reminder that the colonizers and the forefathers of the United States are definitely the new kids on the block. And why is it ignored? Because to appreciate the ancient past of the Americas is to be reminded of genocide. It's a huge neon sign that reads, quote, the people who lived here were killed or made to be refugees in their own land. Much of their cultures were erased, their history deleted. What remains is not important. The ruling elite to this day want us all to focus on the white guys who came later. Anyway, that's Lee Camp, and as always, I think fairly astute commentary on this issue. And I'm hoping that actually, we kind of begin to recognize it as a really important element of our history. Yeah. So, Chopin, speaking of my history, which doesn't go quite back as far and has not yet succumbed to either destruction by lava or mud, my love affair with Frédéric Chopin, and I'm talking about a platonic love here, okay, folks? It started with the Three Stooges. Yeah, true story. Not the actual Three Stooges, but there was a woman who lived a few doors down the block, and it was a hill, a big hill. Her name was Mrs. Truesdale, and she was from Scotland, and she had a really strong Scottish accent. And it was unusual in a neighborhood that was mostly Irish, Italian, and French-Canadian Catholic. So, and we were really kind to her. We would go down, probably because our parents made us, we would go down there and shovel her stairs, and her stairs were like 20, and they were steep. Remember, it's on a hill, so it was no small job. When she ended up having to move, she asked my parents if they wanted her piano. And I was like, yeah. I was 15 at the time. And I remember we had to hire a group of piano movers, and they didn't bother to load it onto a truck. I don't know how they got it down the stairs, but once they did, they started pushing it up the road, up the hill. And I remember we were all just laughing. We think, look at those guys are the Three Stooges. Look at them go. They're pushing that piano up the hill. They look like the Three Stooges. Anyway, it was a funny memory. And then, I've been playing the accordion since I was 7, and I enjoyed it. It was fun. But when I started playing the piano, I realized, hey, there's something deeper here than pokers and fun times on an accordion. And I was really taken by it. And so I just started learning how to play the piano, teaching myself. And I came across, it was an old book my mom had that I still have. The book is 100 years old, and it kind of looks it, but it's still functional. And in it is the second nocturne by Chopin in E-flat major. And I started learning that, and I was immediately just captivated by it, like no other piece of music. And the more I learned of Chopin, the more I heard his music, the more enthralled I became. And I have this belief, And this is, you know, there's a lot of beliefs that are really weird, right? I mean, when you're younger, you believe in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. When you're older, you believe in capitalism, who knows what. I have this belief that I was Chopin in a past life. And, it's a belief, right? Yeah. We have the same birthday. I was absolutely captivated by his music from the first listen. He had a lot more talent than I'll ever have, obviously, but I'm a lot healthier than he ever was. He died at age 39, and I'm here, 68 and still going strong. So anyway, fair, good trade-off, right? Low quality music ability, high quality health. Yeah, anyway. So I ended up going to college. I started off as a philosophy major in Marlborough College in Vermont, and the first year went okay, and then I absolutely lost my interest in philosophy when we started debating whether the chairs we sat on existed. And I had been taking music courses, including piano lessons, my freshman year, and I started continuing that in greater earnest my second year, thinking, I really much prefer to do something that seems real, like play music, than to, pontificate about the existence of my chair. And I remember thinking, I really like this. I really want to, I could see myself making a living playing music or, making it a central part of my life. And there was an instructor at Marlborough College, a woman named Blanche Honegger Moise. And she was from Switzerland originally. And I found recently, I didn't realize she lived to be 101. I thought she was ancient when I met her as a student back in 1978. But she made it to 101. And I remember her telling me, how long have you been playing for? I said, I started teaching myself when I was 15 or 16. So she said, you could never be good. You can never be good. You can only play for your own enjoyment. And I said, thank you very much. I mean, I was just kind of blown away by her rudeness. But apparently she was that way with other students as well. If you weren't, playing by the time you were five, you weren't going to be any good. So, and I remember her also saying that, there's music and then there's serious music. To her, serious music meant classical music, classical, Baroque, Romantic, Impressionist music. Music that we tend to think of as occurring in a symphony hall, right? Not silly stuff like Irish music or rock and roll or blues or rap. Yeah, that's not serious music. It's so snobby and it bugged the heck out of me back then. And so I decided to do something rebellious. Can you imagine that? Me doing something rebellious? Well, back when I was a sophomore, when you became a junior, if you were a music major at Marlborough College, you did a junior recital, kind of preparing you for the big one as your senior recital. No one did a sophomore musical recital, but I did. And I decided to use it as an opportunity to make fun of, quote, serious musicians. And I play Chopin. And while I did, there were two friends of mine, sitting up in windows above the stage, blowing bubbles the whole time. I remember I was carried out on stage in a coffin as they resurrected Johann Sebastian Bach and then slapped in the face to make me wake up. We had bouncers at the doors with threatening T-shirts, prepared to remove anybody who was inappropriate. And I put inappropriate in quotes. In other words, I played some, quote, serious music, but I had a lot of fun with it. And we had a lot of fun as an audience. The quality of my music, my performance, is not concert material. Blanche Honegger Moise is right about that. But she's totally wrong about whether or not you can actually enjoy it and get other people to enjoy it as well. Because we, in this non-serious sophomore recital, had an absolute blast. So, I encourage everybody who loves music at whatever level to believe that you have the right and the ability to play, to do what you want, to express yourself. And, if you go to my YouTube channel, you'll find various recordings I've done of Chopin nocturnes. And I do it a little differently. Surprise, surprise. I often combine two nocturnes that have no particular relationship. They just, in my mind, seem like they fit well together. I often intersperse improvisations in between them, and they are on these recordings, they are genuine improvisations because I have no idea what I'm doing or where it's going. And sometimes it doesn't go in a very great place, but for the most part I think the improvisations aren't bad and they're fun. And then I also, again, hearkening back to my days as a sophomore at Marlborough College, poking fun at serious musicians, I dedicate each set of nocturnes to something I love. My wife, the peacemakers of the world, people working for sustainable agriculture, different things like that. My kids. And so each set of nocturnes is dedicated, and I include B-roll that, again, would really tick off the Blanche Honegger Moises of the world. They would not like it. They would not like it one bit. But again, that's how I feel we should all approach music. One musician that I really, really appreciate, who I think has done both a great job at achieving technical ability and also having a lot of fun, is Peter Schickele. Maybe you've heard of Peter Schickele. It goes by the name PDQ Bach. It's a made-up name. PDQ, of course, stands for Pretty Darn Quick. and his most memorable work is called Kentucky Bluegrass. It's a bluegrass manuscript that was found in a garbage can somewhere in some city in Germany. And it's called Blausgrass. So PDQ Bach is allegedly the originator of bluegrass music. But he was so maligned and discarded by his family that it only came to light centuries later when somebody found it in a trash can. It's great. I'm going to play it on the end of this program as out music. And as we go out, I'm going to play you me playing the second nocturne of Chopin in E-flat major.